Okay, I'm Jamie Bach. I'm going to talk about this similar workshop we had at Irvine in March called the View from 5AU. And I guess you could see what planet we were thinking about at the time, because it's in the poster. Okay, so the idea of the workshop was basically to assess what astrophysics one could carry out from the outer solar system. And it was a very open format. And what we did is we collected, we had a specific focus, which was a small infrared optical piggyback instrument. And we collected diverse experts in astrophysics, extragalactic backgrounds, interplanetary dust, solar system science, exoplanets, instrumentations, and mission operations. And we put them all together in a room, and we asked them to, well, first of all, speak, but also to address key questions. And I'll go through these at the end. We had a list of questions that the speakers were supposed to address. The session chairs wrote down responses as the workshop progressed. And I have the notes here at the end, unfiltered. Here's a list of the people we had. Quite a large number, I guess there's about 40 people, 50 people altogether. This is the extragalactic backgrounds and first galaxies side of it. We had people who were specializing in planet finding and debris disks, shown here. And then people from experts in studying the Kuiper Belt, the zodiacal dust cloud around the sun, and planetary science. I should also mention Bill was one of the co-organizers, Bill Reach. Okay, so the original concept for the mission came out of astrophysics, but as time has gone on, we've come to more and more appreciate the planetary applications. Well, first of all, in studying the zodiacal dust, but now actually also looking at what benefits this instrument could bring for studying planets and moons. Okay, but the original conception here is to study the extragalactic background light. And the extragalactic background light is the total brightness looking back to the Big Bang. In astrophysics, as you look further back, further away, you're looking further back in time. And the total sky brightness is related to the total brightness of galaxies and the first objects that form galaxies integrated back to the Big Bang. Okay, and so by studying the extragalactic background light, what it tells you is something about the history of galaxy formation, what populations of galaxies are out there, and how that it's a constraint on how galaxies evolved over time. Hidden under this background from galaxies, there must be a component from the first generation of stars and galaxies turning on. And so what happened in this grand picture of cosmology is after the Big Bang, the universe was went through a period where it was ionized, which we see today when we observe the cosmic microwave background. After this, when the temperature of the universe cooled to the point that this gas became neutral, suddenly the universe becomes transparent. Now, looking back the other way, we know that to the farthest quasars we can view, the intergalactic medium is now ionized. And so something caused the universe to become ionized, and we think it's these first stars and galaxies. This is an epoch where we have very few observations, and the process of these first stars turning on is unclear. It could have happened at a burst. It could have happened in a stepwise progression. This information is encoded in the extragalactic background, so that's the motivation for studying it. This plot here shows the history of studying the extragalactic background. And there are three types of measurements shown here. The first type of measurements up at the top generally are measurements where you measure the total brightness of the sky, and then you subtract all the foregrounds. And the dominant foreground is actually zodiacal dust. And in this band, it's scattered sunlight from dust in our solar system. And that zodiacal foreground is up at the top, off the top of the chart. The second type of measurement is where you count up all the galaxies and integrate their flux. And those are shown by the lower limits. Now, this does not necessarily capture all of the photons produced by counting up point sources. The cosmic microwave background is the obvious example where there's this background that's completely smooth, and you would completely miss it if you did this technique. The signature from reionization is not clear how the sources clump, but it could be, I mean, there will be some clustering, but there can be a large diffuse component that would not be easily resolved into point sources. Okay, so what you see here are measurements that do the absolute photometry technique are up here, and measurements where you count up galaxies are at the bottom. And the total background is somewhere in between here. This red curve is one model, it's not data. And so the main difficulty with these absolute photometry techniques is subtracting the foregrounds. And in particular, the two points here, the star and the red point here, 1 micron and 2.2 microns, were taken with a satellite called Derby. And the difference, which is rather large, is entirely due to the model used to remove the zodiacal foreground. There's a third technique, which I'll just briefly mention, which is by studying pair production from TEV blazars, one can put an integral constraint on the background. But it is an integral constraint, so it's hard to interpret. This is one region here from an earlier measurement. Now, as I mentioned, lurking as a part of this total background is a component from reionization. And the reionization signature, it has a particular wavelength and spatial signature. And the wavelength signature is due to absorption of the neutral medium from the Lyman cutoff. And so depending on the history of reionization, this feature, which is out at 900 angstroms, gets redshifted into the near infrared, and the shape and of that cutoff depends on the integrated redshift history of the first star light formation. So these are models here which show the minimum component. This, which is to say, we know that the universe is ionized. How many photons do we need to do that? Okay, so there has to be at least this many photons to support reionization. The component could be brighter, and these are upper limits based on fluctuation measurements from Spitzer and Hubble. So the reionization component that we're interested in is in here somewhere.
You see that the zodi is plot, is that true regardless of line of sight, even if you're looking at the photon?
Yes. Right. It varies, but at the pole it's like 500 to 1,000 at 1 micron. Okay, now if one goes away from the Earth, this is what happens to the zodiacal foreground. Okay, so there are direct measurements between 1 and 3 AU from, I think, Voyager. There's an optical instrument on Voyager. And then runs out of signal to noise below 3 AU. So everything longer than 3 AU is an extrapolation, but the scattered component here goes down between 2 and 3 orders of magnitude from going from 1 AU out to 5 AU out to 10 AU. There's a thermal component here. You can see that zodiacal dust grains are at approximately the temperature of the Earth at 1 AU, about 300 Kelvin. So the peak's at 10 microns out here. As you go out into the outer solar system, that temperature presumably is going to drop off. So you see this peak going out to longer wavelengths. So there's actually a bigger improvement out here in the mid-infrared even than the very substantial improvement you see in the near infrared. So once again, here's that red curve, and as I mentioned, here's the peak from Earth's orbit at the ecliptic poles. As you go out to 5 and 10 AU, actually this signal comes way down and is, especially out at these longer wavelengths, is actually subdominant, we think, to the extragalactic background. So the idea is you need a small instrument to do this, an absolute photometer, and in a multi-band survey look for this reionization component.
So it's measured at 3 AU. What's the basis for extrapolating that to 5 and 10 AU? What's the assumption made?
Well, so it's Bill's model. So Bill can tell you. Yeah, there are things like the asteroid belt. So this is largely Bill's work, which is to describe the science that one can do on the zodiacal dust cloud and its three-dimensional structure. So here are some results from the inner solar system. These are plots from IRAS, and you see these dust bands in the inner solar system, which are due to dust lanes created by collisions of asteroid families. This is a model for the ring that's known around the orbit of the Earth with resonant trapping that's expected. And I gather Bill's doing some experiments with Spitzer to try and map out this structure. For the outer zodiacal dust cloud, very little is known because our measurements are completely swamped by the brightness of the inner solar system. But astronomers have been working on measurements of Kuiper belt objects, and there's an increasing body of data on Kuiper belt objects. And one of the things that I learned at this workshop is that Kuiper belt objects are driving people's models for how the solar system evolved. So one thing that was mentioned at the workshop, which is news to me, is that there's this model where in the history of the solar system, Jupiter and Saturn got into a resonance, which caused the Kuiper belt to kind of just go crazy. Gravitationally disturbs objects out of the Kuiper belt. Perhaps this is due to causes the early bombardment of the moon, and causes the current structure of bands and high ecliptic orbits in the Kuiper belt. How does the Kuiper belt dust add to this picture? I mean, that's one of the central questions of the workshop here.
That point that you just mentioned about the early disturbance in the solar system is a very good point of connection with exoplanets, where you see migration all over the place. And the fact that it occurred in the solar system,
This is not universally agreed, by the way, this model. And it's been Mike Brown gave a talk of the NEIS model about how it's already people are thinking, the model beyond the NEIS model. Another aspect of zodiacal dust or Kuiper belt science is the composition of the material that composes the zodiacal dust cloud. Now, in the inner solar system, it's probably asteroidal and cometary material, although there's not a lot of information. From doing near-infrared reflectance measurements, one can determine the abundance of things like silicates. In the outer solar system, icy objects, one can get composition in a similar fashion. And so by doing these measurements as one goes out into the outer solar system, you can see the transition in the materials from presumably silicates to icy materials. And it's also known now, I guess, that there's a collisional family in the Kuiper belt that may be responsible for the Kuiper belt dust cloud. There's additional opportunities and synergies, and mostly these have already been mentioned, but parallax effect and microlensing is something that such an instrument could do. There may be some role for transit studies as well. to lend an air of specificity to the workshop, the instrument concept that we kicked around here is called ZEBRA, the Zodiacal Dust and Extragalactic Background and Reionization Apparatus. It's a small telescope, 15 centimeter aperture, with a multi-band absolute photometer, a Fraunhofer spectrometer, which is used to monitor the scattered part of the zodiacal dust light, and a wide field camera, just an optical camera, small thing, for studying the morphology of the dust cloud as the instrument moves out into the outer solar system. As I said, this is a 15 centimeter aperture. This aperture is 2 centimeters, and it's basically a fisheye lens. The instrument package, it's, as I said, it's fairly small. You can see the total size is about 44 centimeters. It's passively cooled. There's a two-stage radiator so that the optics housing sits at about 60 Kelvin. There's an additional third stage radiator here for going out to 5 microns with the absolute photometer that cools just the array to 40 Kelvin. And these shields, these sun shields, are just, they're basically Mylar sun shields. There's another view of the instrument. You can see this 15 centimeter aperture is shared between the absolute photometer and the spectrometer. Because this is an absolute instrument, there are two shutters that close intermittently, so we can monitor the instrument dark level. The instrument, as I said, is not only is it fairly small, the technology is largely in hand. The arrays, because of the off-axis optics, the arrays are actually fairly modest. They're 1024 squared Hawaii's, the 5 micron cutoff for the absolute photometer. And the spectrometer actually uses an earlier version called a Picnic. So the plate scale, which may be of some interest, the absolute photometer, it has a plate scale of 2 arc second by 2 arc second pixels. And for reasons of it has 15 bands going out from half a micron out to 5 microns. For reasons of cost, this pixel scale's held from the shortest wavelength band to the longest wavelength band. And also for reasons of cost, the instrument views these bands simultaneously rather than having a filter wheel. The wide field camera, as I mentioned, is a 2 centimeter aperture, 5 arc minute by 5 arc minute resolution. It has oodles of sensitivity. And for operational simplicity, we chose a very large field of view, 85 degree field of view. But depending on what kind of operations we could do, this could be reduced to get more spatial resolution. And then finally, the Fraunhofer spectrometer, as I mentioned, it's 30 arc second by 30 arc second pixels with a 2 degree field. The choice of aperture and spatial resolution for the photometers due to the density of galaxies for looking at the extragalactic background from galaxies. And for the Fraunhofer spectrometer, it's due to the density of stars in our galaxy. Oh, yeah, total mass, these are very conservative numbers. Less than 20 kilograms, I think, significantly less, and less than 30 watts of power. Okay, sensitivity. This is a sensitivity in a one-hour observation, including dark current removal. So the blue band here is the sensitivity per pixel of the absolute photometer, and the field of view integrated sensitivity, which is what you want at the end of the day, is way down, you know, below this line. This is the goal. The raw sensitivity is actually below that. The sensitivity for monitoring the zodiacal dust through these Fraunhofer lines, which I've shown here, this is the residual based on sensitivity to the to the zodiacal dust in an hour. Finally, this is the sensitivity of a single pixel in the wide field camera, really better than it needs to be. Okay, so here are some of the comments that came out of the workshop, and we had questions on the extragalactic background side, the zodiacal dust side, and the instrumentation, and finally programmatic. So I'll just go through these. On the extragalactic background science, these are from John Mather. Can galaxy formation and evolution models be constrained with the precise measurement of the EBL spectrum? So in red, basically, the EBL measurements are not enough by themselves, because if you're trying to measure, it's an integral constraint, so you don't get all the information about what produced the background. However, the spectrum could be very helpful if it shows sharp features, and the shape of the spectrum due to the UV cutoff gives a constraint on the history of formation. And finally, even in terms of how does it play off with JWST, JWST isn't enough either, because JWST is not going to be deep enough to see the faint sources, many of which are thought to be very faint and below the JWST sensitivity. So this is actually, I think, in the end, a nice synergy that you need both kinds of measurements to probe this epoch. On the planetary science side, questions were, what's the origin of the interplanetary dust? How does interplanetary dust interact with the outer planets? What is the composition of inner and outer solar system material? And how does the solar system dust relate to exoplanet systems? So these are notes from Bill, and I've just highlighted a few comments. So Mike Brown said, you know, Kuiper belt dynamics are exceptionally messy, and can measuring dust production give meaningful results? And so, you know, as I said, I think this is really the question. Can Kuiper belt dust be used to constrain models of the solar system in the same way, or provide more information compared to current studies of Kuiper belt objects? I think that we're still discussing that. Chaz said, you should think of this instrument as a site survey to 5AU for future astrophysics observatories for exoplanets, and use it to understand the local Zodi as a template for exo-zodiacal systems. Greaves and Wyatt indicated, well, you know, there's quite a diversity in exo-zodiacal systems. Our system is exceptionally undusty, and how are these going to influence our measurements for those other systems? And finally, there was a comment here from Casey Lease about mineralogy studies, indicating that the composition studies, I mean, he would really like to see us push out to longer wavelengths, out into the thermal infrared to get more information on the not just ices and silicates, but composition and size of zodiacal dust. Okay, on the instrument side, so what instrument parameters are needed to remove foregrounds? And I mentioned how the requirements have really come from the EBL side. let's see. Sorry, unfortunately, these are a little hard to read. Okay, well, we talked about the need for doing a detailed study on foreground removal. Polarization, maybe looking at polarization in addition. Microlensing, the issue was whether we had enough spatial resolution to do parallax measurements. And Andy Gould seemed to think 2 arc seconds was a reasonable choice, but would prefer 1 arc second, and noted that there's some operational costs in responding on short times. What? Yep. 2 arc seconds. What are the instrument parameters most useful for planetary science? How much actual information for composition studies, spatial resolution, wide field, and thermal imaging? Well, let's see here. So the band photometry can tell you gross changes in composition. And another question that came up was whether, you know, you'd want to do these observations with the absolute photometer kind of in line of sight, or have information all over the sky with the wide field camera. Another question was, what cadence of observations do we need during cruise for understanding the dust cloud? And so this is, you know, that's a good question. We don't really have an answer, but we don't think it would be frequent. However, it needs to be worked out in detail. And all, you know, obviously this is coupled to how the spacecraft is steered and pointed, and what the cost would be for doing observations during cruise. I thought one of the last questions that we've made some progress on more recently is, what's the potential for actually taking this instrument and using it to do planetary observations for the prime planetary mission of whatever that may be, but often observations of moons in the Jupiter or Saturn systems? Well, so first of all, the issue is background, and the zodiacal dust is very low background, whereas planetary bodies are very high background. I've actually looked at that, and even though they're quite bright, as long as the arrays can be designed and clocked out sufficiently quickly from the beginning, it can be done. It seems like it's largely okay. One constraint we noted is that Jupiter instruments have to deal with a very high radiation environment. So if you build an instrument like this for cruise phase for Jupiter system, in order to use it at Jupiter, you have to deal with these very high radiation this environment. It isn't clear yet whether one would choose to operate it in Jupiter's orbit because of that constraint. However, Saturn doesn't have this problem, and Saturn also provides an additional benefit that you could use this instrument kind of as a mission extension while it's actually at Jupiter in addition to the cruise phase. Okay. Obviously, for extragalactic background science, the instrument requirements are very unique, and so is there potential for a planetary instrument making these measurements? And I think the consensus here is that it seems pretty difficult to take a planetary instrument and turn it to this particular application. And so what we've been doing is looking at turning that around, saying we've got this instrument, and what capabilities are added to planetary capabilities. And actually, we can do quite a lot. So. As long as the system is sufficiently flexible to deal with the higher backgrounds. Okay, programmatic questions. These are from Mike Werner and Mike Hauser at the end. So what is the desired long-term objective that we are working towards? And so these are pretty clear, the solar system aspects and for measuring the zodiacal dust cloud. Astrophysics, measuring the extragalactic background light. Don't lose sight of important near-term objectives. We want to reduce the uncertainties by other techniques before going to 5AU. Need to consider what JWST can do. How can we build support and interest in the astronomy and planetary communities to help achieve these objectives? So there's a lot going on here. There needs to be better communication. So here are Mike's suggestions. Convey to the planetary community that observations address fundamental questions and that there are no ways to get the data and that cruise phase observations can do good planetary science. Develop a convincing model of the instrument performance to convince the skeptical that we can deliver what we promise. Set up an informal website, stay in contact. There's a format of using the AAS. And in fact, there's a AAS special session opportunity this winter that we could take advantage of. And in fact, one of the co-organizers from this conference, Asanta Kure, has submitted a request for a special session on cruise phase science. So there's this forum on exoplanets organized by Dan Coulter. There's also some other near-term opportunities. The EJSM mission has a workshop in May in Europe and again in Southern California in July. And there are emerging opportunities and new frontiers in discovery. Okay, how can we get increased visibility at NASA? My suggestion is to work through the various advisory panels. So there's been mention of the Outer Planets PAG. Pat mentioned that. There's also the ExoPAG, and there's the Small Bodies PAG as well. And people who are at this workshop have contacts to those PAGs. So we should be looking to give reports to them so that these ideas can bubble up through the advisory structure. We plan to send reports to John Morse. And here's another important point that Mike made. We're in the regime here of what he calls playing catch-up ball, which is, how do we get these things into the level one requirements rather than using existing capabilities? And so I think what Mike's envisioning here is by working through this advisory structure, we can get these advice fed back so it could be included in a forthcoming AO. There are some opportunities here within the new NASA. Especially the rage this year is looking for technology angles, and are there technology opportunities that we can glom onto? And examples are power and propulsion, especially. Okay, and then finally, what's our best mission option? So one possibility has been to propose a dedicated mission for extragalactic backgrounds and astrophysics. This hasn't been successful in the past through the MIDEX program, and there have been a couple of tries. John Mather and Chaz Beichman both tried this in the mid-late 90s. Another option is to hitch a ride with the Discovery or New Frontiers flagship mission. And has been mentioned, it's hard to do this a posteriori. It really requires getting in at the beginning. And then it is possible to repurpose solar system missions. An example of that is epoxy. But to get something that does exactly what you want seems like the best way to go forward is to jump in at the beginning. Okay, so that's my talk. Any questions?
On it?
Sure. This one that with the.
Yeah, that's right.
Right. I'm sorry about the format of the screen here.
So, the thing I was interested in is have you gone so far as to do a mass, a power, and a cost rough estimate for what this combined package would entail versus what an ordinary camera, like just the first third of this, would require for an ordinary planetary mission?
Right. Well, we're in the process of doing that. I mean, you have to realize this is a pretty small study so far. So, you know, obviously we have a mechanical drawing. I just have some money again now to start and look at that, to look at that exact question. So I don't have an answer for you right now in terms of how many kilograms or how many watts. But that's the next order of business, is to, you know, price out and resource out each of these components.
I agree that the way to influence the process is through the advisory process. Are you aware of anyone had done the science drivers to do this activity? The only thing I had seen is your meeting, okay, the FIAAU meeting, in which you had some science. But had anyone done this before? A group, a panel, or committee?
So there are these two previous MIDEX proposals that I mentioned, but that was about 15 years ago, and so the science has evolved a lot since this happened.
To me, probably a good recommendation from the SAC is to get the National Academy of Science involved, because until you have a panel in which you have a National Academy of Science level type of panel, national panel, that will make a good comprehensive list of possibilities. I think then you can invoke all of those and proposals, future proposals, because that provides you the recognition that, that normally is the one accepted at agencies like NASA. So.
Mm-hmm.
But so far, I mean, people have, this has come from the bottom up. I mean, PIs coming up with these ideas, but there had never been like a study that really provide validity and visibility to this objective.
Right.
And I think there are enough very interesting ones and new ones, very recent one, including the exoplanet twist, that I think should be there. But it's like you really need someone to validate this.
So, this is it's a tricky question because, as you know, as I said, this. The original design came out of extragalactic background studies, right? We picked the pixel scales and the bands and the apertures based on those requirements. And we picked this instrument for planetary science, for mapping out the zodiacal dust cloud. Now, you know, maybe the details here aren't exactly right, but that was the driver. We studied each of these things and went through, is that right? If you have a larger body of scientists, then the question I think becomes, you know, do you get driven by other science objectives? Microlensing, for example, or composition studies, going out into the thermal infrared. Those requirements are what's going to drive us.
Yeah, it's interesting. Someone did a study recently of the exoplanet raw maps that NASA put since the 70s, 80s. One program you may remember, TOPS, the World Other Planetary System, and look at all the milestone. And this was this fellow from University of Arizona, Ricky.
George Ricky.
And he discovered something really interesting, that this roadmap show all of this milestone. And he said, it happened 20 years in the meantime, very little hardware, okay, very little things have been flying. However, most of the milestones have been accomplished. He said, discovery of exoplanet, imaging of direct imaging of exoplanet, atmosphere study of exoplanet. He had like six. All of them have been done with a few samples, right? No hundreds. But interesting, he was saying that having the value of having this roadmap is that people get inspired and go after things with sometimes very with very little hardware, very little grants or funding, but a lot of ingenuity.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting. So he said, I hope this is not, there were some people from NASA that included me. I said, I hope this is not a lesson to NASA that they do the roadmap and they don't fund anything and people will do it anyway. Okay? But it's interesting that with the exoplanet, I was puzzled about how many things have been done by people mostly from the ground. Although at that time they thought it was impossible to do any of this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I think I see a role of having someone thinking about what can be done from this these distances, heliocentric distances from 5 to 40 AU, because there's a lot of neat things that have not been considered before.